Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this evening, the lawyer you love to love? I don't know. It's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's funny, between this and Dark, I'm really giving no thought whatsoever to the introductions to our podcast lately. But we are here to talk about the latest episode of Perry Mason, Chapter 3. Right? It's so nice that they don't title these. Although you'd think if there was one series that you could get, you should have like chapter titles, it's something that's based on a characters that were from, you know, dozens and dozens of well-known books which had chapter titles. Actually, maybe they didn't. No. Who cares? All right. So, I literally finished the episode 15 minutes ago. You finished it a little bit sooner than me, but we're still giving you our fresh hot take on the latest episode. So, let me stop clicking and let's start talking. So we opened up, I kind of like the contrast because there's so much going on here. The contrast between Maynard Barnes and EB, you know, they're both holding court, so to speak, with the press. Obviously Maynard's doing the more official, big, giant press conference, you know, with the police, and, you know, just a little bit of sleaze rubbed in there as well, while EB's holding court in, you know, in a barbershop. You know, which my first thought when you see someone holding court in a, certain generations, when I see someone holding court in a barbershop in the 1930s, my first thought is, wait, is this Al Capone in The Untouchables or something?
Right.
But the one thing I kind of liked, well, I mean, I liked all of it, of course. And maybe it was, not maybe, it was a bellwether of other details and things to come throughout the episode. And I think we might have even mentioned this in the previous episode, I'm not sure, podcast. The moment where it's clear that EB had rehearsed all of this and his memory kind of falters a little bit and Della kind of helps him out, I thought that was the most interesting and telling detail in the whole sequence.
Yeah, you see in the montage of him getting ready, too, you see specks of blood in the thing.
Later on, right.
But what you see is, I think, and I think we talked about it, is worrying that the cracks, you know, in EB are starting to show. I mean, he still has some game, and he has the attention of the press, but you start to see that the people around him, he relies upon them very strongly. And Della and Perry, he shows frustration at both of them in this episode, because as he's faltering and he feels the case slipping through his fingers, he's becoming increasingly, I don't want to say mad. He's not really mad. I think it's just lashing out at the feeling like he's losing control.
I would go with mad. I mean, I'll slip out of the, I'll get out of my chronological comfort zone with the episode and just concentrate on everything like you just did, and then piece it together with what we've seen in the previous episodes, and just nutshell it this way. Ooh, that was so nicely said. Wow. Look, the setup initially with EB is, you know, he's a man of stature. He's got some gravitas. You know, he's known Perry for quite some time, known his family. You know, he's kind of been maybe even something of a mentor to him, certainly an employer to him. But all that said, once we get past the initial hiring of EB for the case, and maybe the early interactions between EB and the Dodsons, or the first one perhaps even, I'm not going to say he hasn't been competent. That would be an exaggeration. Let's just say things have not gone EB's way at any point since. And obviously some of it is due to the vagaries of the case, or whatever. But a lot of it is he's just caught unawares. He is at times not quite as up on his game. He it's funny how both he and Barnes, you know, who are, you know, in opposition to each other, both have a considerable amount of bluster to them. You know, they've got their egos going full tilt, perhaps more than any other characters on the show, who aren't affiliated with the church, maybe. Unfortunately for EB, he keeps being, you know, figuratively caught with his pants down throughout, you know, these last couple episodes. Everything, and the fact when you come into this episode and he's so sure of so many things and he's wrong every time. Like, he thought he'd have favor with the judge. Clearly doesn't. The fact that he thought he could control the scenario with the Dodsons, who you had to anticipate were going to have issues with each other considering what has just been revealed. And that kind of doesn't really work very well for him. And his very client herself is so out of it and in such a state of mind that she would actually even say guilty initially, in clear earshot of any number of people in the courtroom before she officially pleads not guilty. The only surprise of him being fired is the fact that we're watching a television miniseries that's 8 episodes, and maybe we're surprised that the person we thought was going to be leading the legal case is fired in the 3rd episode. But other than that, it's not that big a surprise he'd be fired, although the reason why he's actually fired might have nothing to do with his own negligence more the fact that Bagley probably does not want to even help Mrs. Dodson anymore because he believes her to be guilty and, you know, cheating on his, you know, his illegitimate son and so on. But all these mistakes he's been making, the way he's reacting to things, the fact is obviously there's health issues, the way he stares off, him practically begging this other lawyer. I think it's the first time we've seen that character before, because I recognize the actor whose name just flew out of my head before I started talking, but we know him from a number, you know, we all know, I think many of us know him from a number of things. He played God on Preacher. He was in the guy cheating on his wife in Rushmore and a bunch of other things. The fact that he's desperate enough to first be trying to get money from him to help bail out his client or just get any help from someone else, and really no one's going to be giving him help. I started wondering, it's like, okay, if it wasn't for the fact that Perry Mason right now, at this point in time, seems like he's in full throes of being a hard-boiled private eye, I would think that, oh, EB is going to die and Perry Mason's going to have to, you know, come to the rescue as a lawyer, even though, is it possible he has a license to practice law at this point? So I'm kind of curious about that.
It's possible. It's possible he has a license that he's not using, or maybe he had been disciplined and currently is suspended from the practice of law. Mm-hmm. We hear mention in EB's conversation with the gentleman at the club that, you know, there was some weird stuff that about got both of them disbarred several years ago. They talk about that. I don't think the time frame's going to work for that. But to go back to a point you made, it is interesting in a lot of in a lot of these type. Noir scenarios, you would expect to find out maybe the lawyer was hired by somebody because they would lose, and with EB's problems, to hear him fired by Baggerly, Baggerly, if he just wanted the case to go away, as to his son, he may separate them. And that may still happen, because we see Della head into the jail with a retainer agreement later in the episode for the wife. So, right. I'm curious, are we going to see another character introduced that will then be the lawyer for the husband? And maybe they separate that way.
Huh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I would say it's at least possible. It's definitely a possibility. I'm just I'm thinking he that Perry must have a license to practice law. Maybe something had happened and either it might have been suspended at one point, or maybe he got disgusted with it and didn't want to practice, whatever. You know, it's also based on the comments we heard him make, was it like in the very first episode? When the way he was talking about it, the way another lawyer was practicing, it sounded like a lawyer critiquing another lawyer as opposed to just someone who's been in court before.
Right.
Plus, even if this show is just going to be this eight episodes and that's it, and we're only going to see Perry Mason as a PI, you can't get away from the fact that everybody knows that Perry Mason is going to be, you know, this very well-known criminal defense attorney. And while I'm sure it's not impossible, it's not like he's a young man here. Because he was in World War I, which they've established a number of times with flashbacks and whatever. And now we're in 1932. So, you know, you start doing the math. So you figure he's got to be, he's easily a minimum of being in his mid 30s. Probably late 30s, quite frankly. That's a little late in life to suddenly then try to pursue, you know, the practice of, you know, law school and becoming a lawyer. I mean, I know things were different back in the 30s than they are nowadays, but I still think there's probably, you know, several years worth of, you know, education and training one would have required still to become a lawyer. So,
right.
So I'm just saying from a practical idea that the fact he's meeting Paul Drake now and those other things, I'm looking at the bigger picture as far as the origins of the character, that if they haven't slipped it in as a detail that I just clearly missed, which is very possible, I get a feeling even if he never does anything quote unquote practicing law in this series, which might be a little over the top if they did go that route, quite frankly, I do feel we're going to hear something. There's going to be some detail, some comment, some story dropped where we're going to learn that he did practice law at one time. So that way we can see, how he may become a lawyer in the future, especially if they decide to continue the series beyond it. Because I've not read any articles. I don't know if this is going to remain a limited series or if they think they may do successive seasons of it. I mean, I'm sure a lot of it has to do based on the success of ratings wise and whether HBO wants to move forward with it and if it's cost effective since they spent so much money on this show.
Yeah. I think it's either going to be this season will set up him becoming a lawyer or he'll step in at the end and, you know, maybe it, right before trial, during trial, something happens to EB and he's pressed into action. Mm. I think that scene where he was on the witness stand and we talked about him saying things, you know, very lawyerly, that to have that in there other than just as a nod and a wink, to have the only time him be in court is to be a witness. There may be a purpose for that we'll see later. So we'll see. It's very interesting. Three episodes in, EB starting to falter, and faltering more and more each week. His influence and power seems to be largely in his own mind at this point.
Right.
And his
health looks like it's an issue as well with the bleeding and you know his vacant stare at one point as well. So yeah, I had not anticipated that though I guess we did think that EB was probably going to get to a point where he'd end up stepping down. This was going to be the practice that Perry was going to be taking over, since Della Street does, again, as the legend has it, Della Street works for Perry Mason. That's
right.
That's his girl Friday, assistant, secretary, whatever you want to call her. The same way Paul Drake is his PI. So, and we can, instead of, I can get out of the, scene by scene thing and just get right to, just certain aspects of the show like we've been doing previously anyway. The stuff between, Perry and those let's just like those principal characters, because I'm very intrigued whenever they have them play off each other on screen, because these are characters who, whether it be the books or the TV show or whatever, have decades worth of interaction. So it's kind of fun seeing the early you know, interactions, especially Paul Drake, because this is literally the first time they're meeting. And
right.
I'll give the show a lot of credit. I probably did not anticipate that was the way this was going to go down when the show started. I probably should have, because it's not that surprising once we see it unfold how they don't quite get along. And although there's a reason for why Officer Drake is acting the way he is, but and I'll admit it, and then I'm going to let you talk for a couple minutes. Maybe it's what's going on this year, especially the last couple months. There was something about hearing a certain word, which kind of made me wince a little bit, and I was like, "Oh,
okay." I thought, and it was interesting to see, the black police officer beat up the white guy and say, "I can do this because of my badge."
Yeah.
You and I had talked about how strangely timely stuff seemed in this show anyway. And we sort of, I think in that conversation, I found it very compelling. And this went forward and maybe in the vein of Watchmen, but certainly not in the way that Watchmen dedicated an entire episode to the character in that show. It mined that further in this episode. And I think what it looks like to me, there was the scene with he and Della where she, ripped into him for what he did to the wife. And then the scene with him and Drake. And, I would almost say what we're seeing is like the moral education of Perry Mason, to see things in a bigger, fairer light, that I think. And I'm not saying he's not.
Oh, no.
He's just damaged.
I was just going to say, and I don't mean to, I'm not trying to interrupt your point at all. I'm trying to just kind of surf right alongside it, actually. But what I found interesting, and you mentioned it sort of there, was that his interaction with Della, I don't know if I'm saying interaction all the time, his arguing with Della, clearly she was on the more morally right side. What he did, regardless of the fact he didn't anticipate the consequences of it unfolding quite the way it did, was still morally kind of, and she's kind of right about what she's saying. But when he's talking to Paul Drake, honestly, let's flip it to their, I believe they meet three times in the episode. So we're talking about the third time when Paul Drake actually just flat out ask him, "Why are you doing this? Why do you do this?" And he's doing it because he believes she's innocent. So you see what I'm saying? Like on one
hand,
So it's almost like we see both sides of Perry, because on one side he's kind of like, you do what you have to do to get your client out of it, and you figure it'll all work out in the end. And on the other hand, it's like, no, I'm doing what's right because I know the client is innocent, it's more pure. Compared to the stuff with Della. And of course, he's been having this running thing with Della in the previous episode where, she was making the point that, infidelity does not equal murder, So she's right about it. Anyway, go on. I didn't mean to derail you there.
No. I think you're right. But what we see in both instances with Della and with Drake is that, that he calls the wife, a slut, basically, for what she did, for sleeping, with George Gannon. And then he challenges Drake's manhood, in the manner he does.
Right.
And Drake responds. Drake wasn't going to beat him up, but he said that. And then Drake responded violently. I thought what was really a nice twist on it was later when Drake talks to his wife and says, "This guy's just trying to do what he thinks is right, and I beat him up for it." I do think, Drake knows there's something going on, but from Perry's perspective, to come up on Drake, he doesn't know Drake's situation. He doesn't know his world. And we see that really creepy scene at the fruit market, you know, with the tough and the wife. And, you know, Drake's in a tough spot here. This is the 1930s. And, you know, if he goes against his bosses, he's fired and probably worse.
Yes.
So, you know, to say, give me what I want. And when you don't immediately capitulate to challenge his manhood, that, you know, Perry crossed a line, and I think Perry knew he crossed that line. But, you know, it is an artistic choice to go that route in the time we're in. And the moment I saw it, I kind of hated to see that character say it. And in my head, I try to put it in the context of it being the 1930s and the time frame this was in.
It's unfortunate, but it and I hate to be the one to say it, but it's the way. Well, first, number one, beyond it being the way people spoke, but he was also using the term to elicit a reaction. So he wasn't using it as like if we saw Perry Mason using it in casual conversation, i.e., that would be a word that he would commonly use. That I would be far more troubled. He said it basically, just it would have been the same as if he said, well, we use phrases we can. I do feel comfortable saying on the podcast, not that word. You know, if he had called him saying it like an Uncle Tom or something like that, or I forget the other phrase. I think our dad said it the other day. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I might have said it on the podcast.
I totally get what you're saying, and what I like what they did is then when Perry talks about the encounter with EB, he refers to him in the more, you know, polite terms of the time. And when he's privately with white people, he's not referring to black people that way.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a big moment, you know, certainly perked up my ears. And I'm sure, you know, since we've talked about it, yours as well. But that was a great interaction. I think at the end of it, we see, you know, Drake doing basically what all characters do in these type of shows, and that is say, this is all I'll help you and leave me out of it, and you're never left out of it.
No, of course not. Of course not.
You know, you're never left out of it.
Because I just want to throw these little factoids out while we're doing this podcast. Because for some reason, this was the episode. I don't know why it didn't kick in the first or second one. It took me till the third episode to suddenly realize where I recognize several people from. So I'm just, you know, cause like, for example, we've referenced Watchmen a number of times or on the podcast already. And it suddenly clicked to me, the guy playing that, you know, the corrupt, the true, well, they're both corrupt, actually, but the killer corrupt Detective Ennis, that actor we know from Watchmen. He was the Red Menace in Watchmen. The actor is Andrew Howard, but it just clicked. I'm like, wait, I've seen him in a number of things, and if you look him up on IMDb, I'm sure you'll recognize a bunch of credits, but I was like, where have I seen him recently? And I'm like, oh, he's the Red Menace in Watchmen. I just wasn't making the connection because he's wearing the mask the whole time, but there was something about, you know, like his nose and mouth or something that just kept sticking with me. The weirder one was, like, I finally realized where I knew Emily Dodson from, and I couldn't believe that it didn't click the very first time I saw her. Do you know what you know her from?
I can't place it, so why don't you tell me and blow my mind?
I'm 90% sure you watched the show. Do you watch Glow?
Yes.
She's Sheila the She-Wolf.
Oh my gosh, yes, the animal. Yes.
It clicked. Yeah. It clicked in this episode because she had like much more. She was in shadow, and so she had much more dark circles under her eyes, and it just has struck me, like, where do I know her from? And I looked.
Wow.
I looked her up, and I went, oh my god, she's the wolf lady from Glow. I couldn't believe
it. Wow.
So, anyway, I just wanted to
that literally did blow my mind, and as you said Glow, it popped in my head. So that's pretty cool.
Just to put a button on the stuff between the arguing between Perry and Della and Perry and Drake or whatever. The other interesting thing about that, I thought, it kind of goes right along with what you were saying. Perry having this situation with Drake, that's someone he doesn't know. So, like, saying what he said, let's see how far I can push this person to try to get what I want, you know. Della, on the other hand, he knows her full well. You know, the fact that he's not, he shouldn't be surprised by the way she's reacting to what he's done, you know, because then it almost becomes just a, this is the way you view women kind of a thing.
Right.
Know? Which it, you know, again, unfortunately, 1930s probably is. Basically, you know, the woman cheating on her husband is suddenly viewed in a much, much more negative fashion than when those genders are reversed. It's just, whereas a man cheating on a woman is pretty much commonplace. Oh, that's okay. We all do that. You know, and look at Pete later on. When Pete was talking about getting blowjobs, was he talking about from his wife or just on the job?
No, on the job.
Okay, I was pretty sure about that. But for a moment there, I was like, oh, maybe his wife is just happy he's working, so now she's blowing him. Like, no, that doesn't make sense. I think that's not what he's... Everything we know about this character and the fact that he's been referred to as a degenerate makes me think he's getting blowjobs on the job.
I think he's a really good investigator and a really bad person is what we're learning.
I gotta say, we've commended him before on the podcast, but the roles that I'm familiar with Shea Whigham from, it's the ones that come to mind immediately, obviously Boardwalk Empire first and foremost. That's probably his biggest featured role. He was also one of the more central characters in the first season or two of Agent Carter. I know I've seen him on other things. I just don't feel like listing them all, whatever. I'm happy for him because he seems like he's got a role where he's having more fun. He finally gets to be lighter. I'm sure he probably had fun in those other things. I mean, Agent Carter, he probably had a lot of fun in that. But he gets to be the guy cracking the joke. He gets the guy that people react to as opposed to being like the guy with a stick up his ass or the annoying cop or something. There was some show that I really didn't like his character. Oh, was it Fargo? Season 3 of Fargo.
Yeah, he was in Fargo.
Yeah, he was, and I thought he was he was the annoying person in charge that was taking over, and he just wouldn't listen to anything that the Carrie Coon character was trying to tell him. So I really hated his character on that show. I mean, you were supposed to hate him, so it worked, but whatever.
Right,
but here I want more of him on screen. You know, I want to see him do the detective work that he keeps doing. We just keep hearing about it. I want to see him doing it.
Well, in a show that is very heavy, and so far, you know, not as much this week, but we still got some pretty gruesome stuff with the dentures, and I mean, in a show that's like this, he does get to sort of be the comic relief in the show. So it's neat to see him be, he gets to play off Perry as the straight man. Perry's the straight man to his wisecracking, you know, sidekick. And that's kind of a good dynamic.
Absolutely. I was actually happy that there at least were a couple moments in this episode where Perry kind of makes a joke.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you're going to be at the center of what is still essentially a film noir piece, and you're going to be, you know, that, like I said, that hard-boiled PI type, I'm sorry, you gotta crack some jokes, man. You gotta. That's just, I mean, because if you can't just be the straight guy, because that becomes, then you're a pill. And, you know, you can go back to every single one. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's Bogart or Dick Powell or whatever. That's what you got to do. And the line he uses when he's at the meeting with the church board.
Yeah.
About the plugging the holes, whatever. And I love that Sister Alice actually was the only one to kind of react positively to it, whereas everyone else was aghast. And then he says, I'm sorry that, you know, sometimes, you know, he says something along the lines that, you know, the words come out faster than his head can process them, whatever the line is, he says. I kind of enjoy it because that used to be my excuse all the time when I get myself in trouble. It's like, nah, sometimes I don't think before I talk kind of a thing.
Yeah, that was a good scene. And, you know, he has, he's starting to develop that sort of sarcastic comic repartee that you expect in a film noir. I liked the line too. It wasn't funny, but I liked the line in that scene where they're talking about God, and, mm-hmm. and he says, "You know, I God left me in France, or I lost God in France."
No, it's God left me in France. I actually that one I did write down. I don't know. I didn't write down the other one that I actually mentioned.
And that, to go back to a theme we've covered, you know, the sort of drips and drabs of character development that we see, you know, we learn probably Perry had religion at some point that he lost. So, you know, that's one little line that tells you, you know, you're not dealing with maybe a lifelong atheist or a lifelong non-believer. In this show, the storytelling of giving us small details about these characters as it goes along, I mean, I think has been really rewarding, and it's neat to see those come out each week. And I thought that was a big one this week. And the space he said it, to say it in that room full of religious people, I thought that was a really great line. And if I'm going to hijack the podcast and just say, and that leads me to my next thought, if you're okay going to this, and that's talking about Sister Alice. We you know, our question is she sincere or is she a fake? And I think we went a little bit further down the road of at least them trying to convince us she may be genuine this week, as misguided as she may seem. I didn't see it coming that she would go to the jail to meet with the wife and stand up for the wife to her mom. And we see the board of directors of the church getting upset, you know, the sort of don't get involved in a controversy that can hurt the church, go out and speak out about these things. So I thought, I'm really interested where they're going with her character. You know, what is her role going to be in this? Because this being the third episode, you know, a lot of development on her character, it'll be interesting to see where she goes.
It was funny because I actually got, I was struck by the ending. And there was that moment there. This is episode three. If this had been episode seven, I would have said, did they just kill Sister Alice?
Right.
It being episode three is like, okay, no, that's just, maybe she's just out of it. And then she's still imagining this world around her where she's actually on a literal boat, you know, with the waves and everything. But you see what I'm saying? Because that could have played out that way, the way they went about it. And especially what she says is she's going to resurrect the baby. And we're like, wait, what? And I realized, maybe has she drank her own Kool-Aid? Is that what's going on here? But it does say something to what you're, to go to your point. There's more genuineness to her than we might have first thought. I mean, I think she's fully aware of, you know, how this is a show, and and yes, it's a church, whatever, but it's a money making operation. There's no way around that. I mean, they're on the radio. They're putting on these incredible productions and whatever. And the church, I don't know what to call them. Let's say the church fathers or whatever, you know, don't want her saying things and getting out of line like she did last time and stuff. And her mother is there to kind of help try to keep her in line. But I agree. It was the scene when she goes to the jail. Which, you know, if she was going to be what we might have thought of her character before we got to this point, then she would have distanced herself from this. You know, this being probably the most unpopular woman in the city at this point, if not the country. You know, and she's standing by her, despite the fact that we later hear her mother wants her to distance herself from her. So I am very curious where they're going with this story element, because Are those fireworks on my end or your end? I'm not sure.
They must be yours because they're not here.
Okay, it's, they're still blowing stuff up here. It's great. Bye-bye, New York.
up now. Those are loud, too. I mean, I can hear them. Yeah, yeah. Those are pretty good. That's how good we're doing on the podcast. They're celebratory fireworks for all the verbal fireworks we're engaging in here.
They heard about all my new equipment. They're like, oh, wait. His microphone can pick up everything. Let's give that a shot. I mean, I'm picking up like neighbors' conversations next door. I've noticed that at one point in the back of my ear. I'm like going, oh my God. Like, I'm afraid to move in my chair because, just the very, this, I could hear that. Never happened before. I miss Radio Shack. No. Anyway.
So let me ask you a question.
Thank you.
Let's finish the Sister Alice conversation. The thing that struck me about her was, like, we're told she does this ungodly number of performances. And it's obvious, like, she's exhausted. And at some point, they're giving her a drip, like an IV drip to keep her going.
Yes.
I found that to be, another piece of the story that makes us sympathetic to her. In this way, that it's almost like she's the naive true believer that they're just milking for all the money they can get out of her. And there's the line where her mom says, but you are the church and we've got to keep building these churches. And she says, don't put that on me. That's too much. Don't tell me that stuff. And I thought that to me made me more sympathetic to her in a way that I didn't expect to see this soon in this story. I expected her to remain a mystery longer. Now, of course, with what they've done, she may start becoming even more enigmatic as we go forward. But did that sort of surprise you to see that level of detail to show what she was doing? And,
well, there's, speaking of detail, and this is the kind of thing where maybe if I had given the episode a second watch and we were talking about it like a couple days later, like we used to do in the olden times, maybe if I just paused it tonight just to look, which I probably should have done, there was something very interesting towards the early part of the episode. It's when we first time we see Perry in the episode and he's watching, the service that she's doing, the sermon, whatever you want to call it, when, the thing about God is gone and all that stuff. And then he walks out, he goes into the hallway, and then, he's looking at these objects, these things, these items that are under glass. And I was like, thinking, oh, he's admiring what the prop department set up for him. But, and I could be wrong about this. Maybe I am. Because, again, I didn't stop to look. I don't know. But I'm going to go out. I'm going to take a chance. If I turn out to be wrong, I apologize. I think he's looking at different items about her and how she, from her childhood to now, about what led to her to be, Sister Alice. I was looking at the things that were there with the cross and the little shirt and the pictures, whatever. Again, I might be totally wrong. It might be something totally different, and I apologize if I wasted part of the podcast on it. But I remember thinking, that was kind of establishing that this has been part of her life from day one. That this isn't something that she just came to, that she just, she was like 23 one day and decided, I'm going to try to make money on and be a church kind of person. I think this has always been part of her life. So it grounded her as someone this has been the real deal all this time. And I think what's fascinating about her character is I went from being kind of iffy on her last week to really embracing her more this week. And maybe it's her interactions with Perry Mason and then what she does at the jail cell. The fact that someone can have this extensive background and be that person of faith, so to speak, and yet, unlike, say, everyone else in that room, still be human. Still have a sense of humor about things. Still appreciate the slightly naughty little joke that Perry Mason tells, whatever, whereas everyone else was like,
Right.
it made her very, it also made me curious about possible future interaction between her and Perry Mason, although, don't tell Lupe. But I still find that's another fascinating character situation. I don't even know what to make of, but it's just, Lupe, you probably could do better, but okay. But I was taken aback by the IV thing because that's like, that you're not faking that. That's real. That's something. That's crazy that they're doing that. That she's putting herself through so much that she has to go through that. Doesn't he make a joke about that initially? Is it holy water or something?
Yeah,
Okay.
he does.
He's making lots of jokes in this episode. Wee. When he's not trying to, cram a dental plate into a corpse's face, but.
Yeah, I was interested by the structure of this episode. It sort of went all over the place, but somehow was cohesive. And I think we've talked in the past. This was another Tim Patton episode. I noticed it. So Tim Van Patten, I should say, so I don't get corrected.
Who's gonna
not
come?
you. I'm sure if anybody ever listens to this, they'll want to flame me for not saying the van. But it went a lot of places. And just as a note, one of the things that I thought we've sort of talked about how this show tweaks the tropes of film noir. When they go to the sort of underground gambling place, and he wants to meet the boss, usually when the hard-boiled PI wants to go meet the boss, it doesn't end well.
Yes.
Like usually that's when they get beat up or told to scram,
They get beat
whatever.
up, they get knocked out and wake up later on. They dive into a pool of ink and they hang out with Claribel the clown, whatever.
Right. I thought that interaction in the very just direct business-like way it was handled, and the guy was like, "Yeah, go ask whoever you want." I thought that was an interesting twist on that sort of interaction
I
you
agree.
would typically see. And usually you go talk to the seedy club owner, and it doesn't play out that way. But I thought it was really well done.
No, they figured he already got beaten up by the minions of a Hollywood producer in the first episode. And I have to confess, I'm surprised we never that was just a one and done that didn't play a part in the rest of the season. But no, that's fine. But yeah, I was totally expecting that cliche, I would have embraced it because I'm so used to seeing it. So I was surprised by that. So I do agree. Oh, by the way, that you recognize that actor, the guy who was the club owner or the casino owner, I should say.
We do these so quickly after the episode. I did, but I didn't do any research
Oh, I
to
didn't.
place him.
I just recognized him. Oh, I'm not gonna remember his. I'm not gonna remember the actor's name, and I won't waste valuable seconds on the podcast looking it up. But you would know him from Lost. He was the eye patch guy from Lost.
Okay,
Was that, didn't he
yeah,
have like a
I can
far
see that.
name, Renoir, Renard, whatever, I can't remember. But his name was on, we call him Patchy all the time, so it's the guy with the eye
Yeah.
patch. I always think, oh, he's like a lesser James Brolin. So I just look, I'm really like, oh, you look like you could be like, James Brolin's cousin or something. Okay, since we kind of jumped around, I'm just gonna quickly skim and scan to see if there's anything. I didn't. I mean, I do enjoy all the scenes in the morgue. I love the fact that the morgue attendant, or I don't, maybe he's not an attendant. I don't know if he's the actual coroner. I don't know if this is a town that has a coroner or a medical examiner, because there actually is a difference. But we're not gonna get into it in this podcast. How he keeps trying to tell a story that neither one of them are interested in hearing. So
Right.
we never actually hear the entire, we just hear aspects of the story and the punchline about it. We wouldn't have found out if not for the mayonnaise or something. And I'm like, going, I kind of want to hear that story right now. But, come on.
I like that actor because he's another one that when he's in the scene, and I think we may have seen him in every episode so far now.
I think so.
Maybe
Yeah, we have seen him in every episode.
You know, like it's obvious he's sort of a stand-up guy, but lets them pay money to probably get in and do and see things they shouldn't do and see. And but I've enjoyed that. That's always a sort of strangely a light spot when they go to the morgue. It's usually humor. You know, the tie, him going to get the tie.
I love the whole tie routine. That was just a great idea. If I could figure out a way to research that, I just feel like someone has thought of doing that before. That has to have been done before. There's no way they're the first people to come up with that idea. It's such a great idea. I also like the contrast of, because we knew once they mentioned that George Gannon's body went to the other morgue, the county morgue, because it was over city lines or whatever, that they were going to have to go there. And my expectation would have been they were going to have to deal with some other, a totally different kind of a guy and have to convince him to let him see them and go through that whole rigmarole. They totally skipped all that or cut through all that. Instead, they're creeping around this other morgue in the middle of the night trying to find the body. And I wasn't expecting that scene to play out that way. So I like that it kind of heightened the kind of weird, creepy nature. Also, the fact that all these bodies are not on ice. They're just all laying around, you know, in the dark. Kind of tells you, oh, that's the 1930s. Huh? That's the way they did things back then. Or yeah, actually, also maybe 2020 with COVID. No, I shouldn't say that. But anyway.
Well, throughout that whole scene, there's the interesting contrast between Perry and Shea Whigham's character, that Perry is fine and Shea Whigham's character is increasingly bothered by being in the morgue, by being in around the bodies and just is totally uncomfortable there. But Perry is, you know, okay with it.
Well, perhaps as we've seen, Perry is more used to seeing dead bodies all around them. So
maybe exactly.
It bothers him less. I would say right now, off the top of my head, there's probably only two other things of note in the episode worth mentioning before we wrap it up here. But there are two kind of major things, I would say. Let's take the one where we're not really quite sure where they're going to go with it, but it's kind of like, okay, let's see where that story thread goes. And that would be the thing between Baggerly and his son, Matthew Dodson. We referenced it briefly earlier where obviously Baggerly had already fired EB and seems pretty convinced that, you know, because this woman was stepping out on his son, never mind the fact he kind of ignored his son all this time, then she's probably, you know, part of the whole scheme and had something to do with killing the baby. But it's the whole thing where he takes out the blueprint and he wants his son to help him build this town outside the city, you know, 30 miles away, the city of, was it Girard or Gilead? I think I wrote Girard, but I don't know if that was.
I think it was Girard.
Yeah, Gilead, that would be too weird because of, you know, Handmaid's Tale. But and I was like going, wow, I didn't think that Gil Girard had that big a fan club in the 1930s. No, anyway. But do you think anyone's going to get the Gil Girard reference and listen to this podcast?
I don't know. I would make a Twiggy joke, but if they don't get that, they wouldn't get the Gil Girard. So
anyone who heard Twiggy, they probably think you mean the model.
Exactly. You know, if you went beady beady beady, no buck.
God, and that was Mel Blanc, man. Good trivia. Anyway. So you had that. I don't know where they'll go with that. You get these other things that don't seem to be specifically connected to the actual kidnapping murder thing. But part of me, because it's a film noir thing, it always seems like there's these other more elaborate conspiratorial situations that end up being kind of mushed together and interconnected, and that's why, you know, one thing leads to the other, you know, I don't need to list all the examples of it, from everything from Chinatown to Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
You know? Right.
So you kind of, because we were already kind of curious, we figured, okay, the church factors in because that's how we get to Baggerly and the money and whatever, and people would be aware of it that way. So that's that could simply be the church connection. this building a town thing, I don't know if that's going to play any part in the rest of this. I mean, they went through the trouble of showcasing it here, but I don't know. And I'm still waiting, because now we're 3 episodes in, so at least they're holding back on one mysterious aspect. I'm wondering at what point we're going to see who's really behind this. Because right now the only person is the cop, and we know the cop is not cannot possibly be the main guy. There's got to be he's got to be doing this at someone else's behest. So I'm just waiting for that, because that has to be the case, I'm thinking.
Well, and we have the allusion to another person when the main goon goes to the Chinese store and goes into the back room, right. And the woman says he's not happy about this.
Right. Yeah.
And we don't know who that is. Now, could that be Baggerly? Maybe. But, you know, it's doubtful, but it could be. And so there is another thread that, I mean, it could be not related to that city. It could be. But that's what's impressed me about the writing in this show. Rather than be deliberate, things have proceeded quicker than I expected, and new paths have been opened in the writing so far. It's hard to believe we have all this done in 3 episodes. I mean, this show has been so rich that, you know, a lot of shows would have taken 8 episodes to get all this out to a conclusion. And we're only 3 episodes in where we are now. So
yeah, what they're doing, what I think they're doing well on the show, and where some shows have faltered at this, some shows tend to be guilty of spending too much time on setting things up. It's set up. You know, when are we going to finally go on the journey? When is it going to be a follow through? When is there going to be a payoff? You know, and people can sometimes not. And the way you kind of disguise that to a slight extent is, well, you have fun, silly crap going on while it's happening. But if you still realize we're not actually going anywhere at the end of whatever season it is, you realize we didn't really move forward very much. Great example of that, Preacher season 1. Kind of it's setting up. It doesn't really go anywhere for most of that season. It doesn't mean it isn't entertaining. But it's one of those things when you get to the end, like, you're kind of keenly aware, like, we figuratively and literally didn't really go anywhere in the season, and we just spent all this time just setting this up for the next season. So it's kind of cool that they've been, there is obviously a lot of setting up the world here and who these people are, but they're doing it at the same time as moving the plot forward. Whenever we talk about the best shows are always those that almost seamlessly, it's very hard to do it seamlessly. I'm not saying this show does it seamlessly either. I can only think of a couple that do. The shows that can push plot and character together at the same time, to me, are always the best shows. Shows that we love to talk about the most, like me and you. It could be Breaking Bad, it could be The Americans, those are two right there. Those are excellent examples of shows that push character and plot at the same time. There's always a lot of plotting with those shows, but there's also a lot of character development happening at the same time. Shows that tend to drift the other way, they can still be great shows. Rectify is a great show, but it's really character. It's really more about character, not so much plot. You know, Mad Men's a little bit like that too. A little less on the plot, a little more on the character. But I think the best shows are the ones that kind of like handle it hand in hand. I'm not saying by the time this is all over, I'm going to say Perry Mason is one of the best shows. That's a bit much. But I am really enjoying it, and the fact that it's in the same vein as something like a Boardwalk Empire, but I think it's moving at a much brisker pace than Boardwalk Empire. Maybe it's because I know it's an 8-episode story and they want to just get the arc done. That's probably why. I am really enjoying it. So they're doing a good job so far, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the last time that I went to an app at the time the show was supposed to come on and clicked on it to start it at the earliest moment I could. I mean, it's been some time for that. And so at 9 o'clock I was ready to go and I like, you know, this show jumps right in too. You hit play and it just does the Perry Mason title card and you're off and running. And it's really, you know, I mean, you think,
I missed the title card. I just realized I didn't notice the title card in this episode.
It just pops on, and it pops on like in the middle of the press conference, and you just move right on up to the DA, and it picks up right after the arrest, and just takes off right there. So, yeah, I thought that was really great. You have any other thoughts we haven't covered that you'd like to talk about?
There's only one other thing I don't feel we really mentioned, but I'll just mention it really quick because I'm trying to stick to our little rule about these podcasts, even though kind of going over with Dark lately, but only by a few minutes. The one thing I don't think we mentioned is, Jesus Christ, the detective's freaking trying to slap a confession out of Emily Dodson at the end there, and Della kind of catching them it, and I'm kind of wondering what's going to happen with that, if anything. Is she able to do anything with this? Is the judge going to listen, or is the system so corrupt it won't matter? And the fact that they were doing that at all was just kind of like, oh, Jesus. That to me was kind of like the... And also the fact that both detectives are doing it. So there's no question. Even if the other guy might not be in, maybe he's not, has nothing to do with this whole, you know, kidnapping murder conspiracy, he's still not a good cop.
Right. Yeah, the thing about that whole scene that was remarkable was the language that Della used was accurate, that, you know, she wasn't supposed to be unsupervised, that she could call the judge and they'd be in trouble. It was a court order that happened. I mean, Della also is well-versed in the law. We're learning that. And, you know, Della right now is the best advocate for, you know, Mrs. Gannon. She's the best. Or not Mrs. Gannon, I'm sorry.
Not yet.
Too late. Yes, but you see, she is the one fighting the hardest for that client. And I think, you know, we see Perry is slowly being won over to this case. You know, and it's good to see EB beg for that money and say, like, I've got an innocent girl. I just want the money to get her out. Like, you see that the team, you know, have come to the place of believing in her innocence and are willing to fight for it. And that scene, that would be a great courthouse moment to see the suppression hearing for that statement and, you know, see EB cross-examine those cops and, you know, I'm sure early in the season, the judge will rule against him. And, you know, I mean, hey, I lose most of my suppression hearings even when I shouldn't. So I'm sure in the 1930s, it was just as bad and worse. So, but yeah, I mean, that certainly is something that could be litigated and should be litigated. And you could get testimony and have a pretrial hearing to suppress her statement.
I'm going to go out on a limb. Something tells me we're not going to go that route, because I don't think I've ever seen that in any film noir piece, really. So I don't know. But it makes me curious because they are, you know, they are avoiding some cliches, and also the fact is we are dealing with a show that's called Perry Mason. So even if Perry Mason himself is not the lawyer, you figure we are going to get some legal wrangling at some point in the series, just because it's Perry Mason. I am very intrigued by how they will eventually resolve this. And also, if there is a courtroom scene. Now, obviously, if Perry's not the one at the bar, they probably wouldn't bother doing this anyway. But if some crazy situation was to happen, and I don't think it will, because I just think it would just be a bit too far-fetched in the confines of the story that we're watching. But if somehow Perry was somehow had to take on the role of being a lawyer, what's the one thing that people remember Perry Mason for? It's famous or infamous, if you want to look at it that way, for doing more than any other legal drama ever. I mean, you can take your Matlocks or whatever. Perry Mason was the one that was the pioneer in doing this. Do you know what I'm talking about before I say it? You must know. You know what I'm talking about.
Is this the gotcha moment on the witness stand?
Yes.
because the reason I say that is in my legal career, I've had like two of them out of hundreds of trials where a witness suddenly says something so amazing that, you know, you had no idea they were going to say, that, you know, we jokingly, you know, I mean, lawyers sometimes call that like your Perry Mason moment or your Matlock moment, you know, where the case turns on one witness on some amazing piece of cross-examination.
Right. Yeah. Generally speaking, you don't get your Colonel Nathan Jessup moment when you're a lawyer. It'll be a cool feather in your cap you'll be telling your grandchildren about one day, but it doesn't typically happen. Not like that. Of course, if you had Jack Nicholson on stand, I guess you would be telling them that.
Exactly.
See, I got away from Perry Mason and Matlock. I went to the best scene. Anyway. Yeah, that is all I got, and we just skipped past the hour mark, so I am ready to, you know, adjourn this case until our next episode. Oh, God,
I think we've covered it pretty well. Loving the show, enjoy the podcast, and look forward to next week.
I'm the same, and the fact that I'm now. I love the fact that I sandwiched watching Perry Mason between recording two different podcasts, because me and Dan recorded one of our dark podcasts and we finished with that a couple minutes after 9. So I'm not kidding. I went from recording the podcast, sending him the file, going to the other room. Oh, it's 9:13. I got to put on Perry Mason. Thank you, DVR. And that's what I was telling you. I'm running late because between I had to start it late and taking notes, it just, and it's like, oh, 5 minutes later. Oh, let's record again. This is supposed to be my day off. Anyway, if after that pathetic sob story, if you guys enjoy this podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our podcast page. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Perry Mason, like Dark, and of course Better Call Saul and so many others. You can find our website page, or whatever the heck you call it, stvdpodcast.podbean.com. It's spelled just the way you think it is, and that's where you can find, as of this podcast, it'll be 258 episodes of the Serious TV Drama Podcast. There's actually even a few good ones in there. You can also just follow us. Oh, did I say iTunes? Let's say iTunes. If you still have iTunes, go into iTunes. Subscribe to our feed, Serious TV Drama Podcast, where you can subscribe to our feed and rate and review us. Hey, by the way, I tried to see if we could get on Spotify, but Spotify, I'm concerned about the music licensing issues, and even though we don't do this for profit, so we don't got to worry about anyone coming after us, Spotify might not see it that way, so I don't think, until we get to a point where we're not using any musical clips on the podcast, and that might happen one day, we cannot join the Spotify ranks, unfortunately. But you can follow us on Twitter, STVD, at STVD Podcast, STVD as in Serious TV Drama. That's it. Brian, I look forward to getting back together with you next Sunday for Chapter 4 of Perry Mason. And for all you guys out there, if you're listening just to the Perry Mason podcast, we'll see you next week. And if you're listening to Dark, congratulations. And you'll be hearing multiple podcasts probably during the course of the next week or so. And that's all I got. So thanks, Brian, and I'll say goodnight to you, and you can say the final goodbyes.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Good night.